Well, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report Richard Dolan, who I and most everybody consider the definitive, I would even say intellectual or academic, but certainly researcher of the whole phenomena of UFO and all sort of high strangeness associated with it. And this is a topic which I consider very important, but it's a topic that requires enormous intellectual capability and energy because it's a very wide-ranging phenomenon. It touches every aspect of our lives in one way or the other, and yet it's been very suppressed and censored with enormous amounts of disinformation. But it also gets you into topics that are so far out of our framework and frankly just so weird that it takes a great deal of effort to bring objectivity to it. And Richard has achieved that with a series of books. He's joined us on the Solari Report, but he has a new book, which I think is extraordinary and to me is the definitive work on this whole phenomena. So if there is only one book you ever read on UFOs, this is it. And if you want to get your friends who never wanted to look at this topic before, but really need to look at it because it's so impactful in their lives and their future, this is the book to give them. This is the book I'm hoping that can go mainstream in a very, very big way. So I would ask every one of you to not only read it, but encourage other people to read it as well. And before I bring in Richard, I just want to say one other thing. I'll never forget reading an obituary, believe it or not, of a wonderful scholar from Mali. And someone said that when he died, it was as if a library had burnt down. And what I will tell you is the man I'm about to bring on to me is that extraordinary. He is literally a walking library of this phenomena and brings to it not just encyclopedia knowledge, but the ability to put it into a human and intellectually or a framework with intellectual integrity. So as far as I'm concerned, he's not only a national treasure, but an international treasure. So I've embarrassed him enough. And with that, Richard, welcome to the Solari Report.
Thank you so much, Catherine. That's the nicest introduction I think I've ever gotten, honestly. Thank you.
Well, don't burn down. We need you.
No, I don't want to.
So UFOs for the 20th century mind. Please explain, in 100 words or less, how did you become the leading intellectual on the planet on this phenomenon, outside of the intelligence agencies, I should say?
Yeah, we'll give them a pot. Well, I didn't expect when I was a lot younger to be going into a field that was so fringe, honestly. Back in the olden times, I was working very diligently to become a professor of history at a university. That was always my goal. I was always good at that. I loved studying history and politics. And through my 20s, tried to work my way through and understanding this world the best I could, trying to peel away. Even in my 20s, I think I was quite aware, a lot of people are, that we're living in a world of propaganda and illusion. And it became clear to me that I need to peel away those layers. In my early 30s, I stumbled into the UFO topic. It wasn't that I was trying to. I came across one book in particular that talked about the UFO cover-up, and I thought, really? And, I think everyone at some point in their life wonders about the UFO phenomenon. Is there something to it? Is it real? Is it legitimate or not? And I thought, here I am studying at the time U.S. national security policy, early Cold War period, Harry Truman era, birth of the CIA and relations with the Soviets and so on. And in that context, I stumbled into the UFO cover-up theme, which dealt with that period, of course. And I thought, hey, you know what? This is not in any academic book anywhere that I'm aware of. And if there's even the slightest bit of legitimacy to this topic, why would it not be of interest to professional historians or academicians or anyone else? So I thought, well, I'll take a few months out of my life and just find out for myself if I think that this is legitimate or not. And that's what took me down this 20-year rabbit hole I've been doing for 20 years. trying to figure it out. The first attempt for me to figure this out was my first book. That was UFOs in the National Security State that came out about 14 years ago. And that got me started. What I've discovered is that the UFO topic is one of several, like I call them crowbars for prying open the illusions of our world. It's not the only one. You can get into it through economics. You can get into it through other types of political analysis. But it is true that the UFO topic is like a gateway that I feel allows us to peer into so many facets of our world. And it's the ultimate red pill experience. I wish it were as easy as taking one red pill, though, because what I find is,
it leads to multiple red pill experiences.
I find more and more. So I'm taking red pills every few months now, a new one. That's how it goes. But yeah, it's the most amazing topic I think, for me, I could have ever gotten into, and I find it's incredibly rich, incredibly profound, and I'll be working this topic until I can't work anymore.
So explain to us, what is a UFO?
Well, technically speaking, it's an object that you see that is not conventionally explainable, typically an unidentified flying object. And what we find in historically, the thing that really turned me on initially was simply learning through the limited amount of declassified documents that are available. I say limited because so much is still remains off limits to people. But during the late 1970s in particular, we had a Freedom of Information Act in this country, in the U.S., that actually was somewhat useful, during which time was the Jimmy Carter years, where several thousand pages of documents relating to UFOs were released. This is after Watergate, after Vietnam, at a certain moment in American history where it was possible to get some of this information out. And what did we discover? Well, we found that U.S. military groups, Army, Navy, Air Force, Central Intelligence Agency, despite all their claims to the contrary, were having some very significant encounters with unknown, unconventional objects over sensitive airspace that they could not figure out. We have statements from leading generals, leading intelligence officials to that effect. So whether it means that UFOs are extraterrestrial or not, that's a secondary issue, as I see it. Primary issue.
You're talking about, if you count, this is the way I say it, because you know me, Richard, I think of everything in terms of money. If you count up all of the legitimate and documented sightings, you know, you just take all of the sightings, prune out the ones that, you know, truly could be weather balloons, and you get down to just what's concrete, hard sightings. First of all, it's a phenomenal number going on all over the world.
Yeah.
And if you just price out what it would cost to build all those spaceships, you're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars. So somebody has that manufacturing capability. Somebody has those financial resources. You know, who is it? Because if it's not off planet, it's on planet. You know, where is that happening? Where did those resources come from?
Yeah, that's a really on point question. And it's financial resources and also, I would say, scientific and engineering resources.
Right. You know, we're talking about technology, which is way beyond anything which is overtly understood or known in our society.
And that's the problem. What you find in the document trail, again, such that we're able to obtain, is that these were some of the questions that American analysts were asking in the 1940s and 50s. Not so much the financial aspect, which I think that's key, but they were certainly asking, who's building these things? Is it the Russians? Is it us? Do we have a secret black budget program that's doing this? And frankly, when I go through the document trail, I'm just not seeing a whole lot of evidence leading to, at least in the early period, the 1940s and 50s, American or Russian manufacture of these objects. There's a lot of speculation that this is possible. You have researchers today like Joseph Farrell and a few others who are following up on the possibility that this comes from World War II German science, Okay, fair enough. But even that's not really a slam dunk, in my opinion. And that still begs the question, if this is a fully terrestrial operation, then as you're saying, where is it from? Where is it based out of? That's still a mystery, in my opinion. You know, who's making these things?
It's interesting, you know, I am, because he was a partner at Dillon Reed, I've always been interested in James Forrestal, who became the Secretary of Defense and died mysteriously in the late 40s. You know, and many argue it was for a variety of political reasons, one being that he wanted transparency around this issue. But I was looking at a chronology related to, he had set up something called Project Saucer, which became Project Sign. Are you familiar with this?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
And I was just reading.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I was just reading that this is what the chronology said, and I was going to check it with you. 1948, August 5th, unanimous agreement of Project Sign scientists and intelligence officers. The UFOs, they're talking about the Roswell incident and some of the other sightings that had happened at that time. The UFOs are spacecraft from another world observing the Earth for an unknown motive, clears Directorate of Intelligence without a single dissent en route to Chief of Staff General Hoyt Vandenberg, who refused to release the report because it would cause a stampede. Go public versus don't go public factions take form in government and debunking starts.
Yeah. That's known as the estimate of the situation. It's a famous report. It's a legendary report. No one's actually ever read the estimate outside of the classified circles. We are very confident it existed. There were a number of people from that time who talked about it. And indeed, this was the result of a tremendously vivid sighting of two Eastern Airline pilots from the summer of 1948 that was very clearly seen, got a lot of attention for the people upstairs. And indeed, there was a report by what's called Project Sign that did end up on the desk of Hoyt Vandenberg, who was chief of staff of the Air Force at the time. And as you say, exactly. He said, no, this is not the answer I want. And that was that.
Before I drag you into the creation of the national security state, let's just go back and touch on one thing, because you did a very good job in your book of describing what's called ancient visitations. In other words, the evidence of UFOs being sighted globally and sort of relationships with other civilizations. You know, this has been a global phenomenon for centuries. This is very old. So maybe if we could just touch on ancient visitations before we start to set up the national security state, that'd be great.
By all means. Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of ancient aliens, especially since the television show on the History Channel, I think has become a very big thing that people like to talk about. It's always been a strong interest of mine as well, even though I hadn't written about it a lot until this book. My own feeling is that when you look at the sum total of evidence of, say, pre-20th century sightings, you've got a lot of very suggestive and interesting stories, and that's what I would call them, not really reports, that are suggestive that there are others that have interacted with us. One of the things that I try to point out in this book throughout, and including in that particular chapter, is that we still need to keep our objectivity glasses on when we go over all of this evidence. In other words, there's a lot of evidence that people talk about as legit for the ancient alien phenomenon, which I don't believe is as legitimate as some other people think. I'm not a huge convert to some of the writings of people like Zachariah Sitchin, at least not 100%, who argued that the Anunnaki came from another planet and enslaved or created humanity to dig for gold. I'm not won over to that argument. I'm not saying that there are not ancient intelligences that have interacted with us, but I think some of the evidence that's put out by him doesn't really meet my personal standard of what I would consider evidence. And I try to explain that in this book. A number of other things that people have talked about, there's stories that just float around, copied from one website to another. The ancient nuclear event that was supposedly had taken place in India, I found was just built on spurious translations of texts that really were inaccurately and also maybe deliberately mistranslated. So there's a lot that's not legitimate, in my opinion. On the other hand, there are truly inexplicable and conventionally unexplainable events from our ancient history that, in my view, tell me that we have a great hole in our history,
right?
You know, in our conventional understanding. So, yes, I think that there are, and there are certainly a number of stories that have come from ancient times to our own that I don't know how to explain away. I mean, there are sightings from 17th century Russia. There's sightings from medieval period. There's sightings from ancient Egypt and elsewhere that when you just read these accounts, it's very difficult for me to explain away as the natural phenomenon of, you know, intelligent fireballs that seem to maneuver, that go away, that come back, that scare the hell out of the people who are watching them. A number of these. And then a couple of very good 18th and 19th century accounts that were dug up by people like Charles Fort and some others that show objects leaving the water. There's one from 1845 in the Mediterranean that was noted by a ship's captain and his crew, an object just off the coast of Sicily coming out of the water in 1845, a luminous object, and then flying off. So there are some very bizarre, suggestive stories that do tell me that we may have the presence of a quiet presence of a group that that is here for their own purposes.
Right. So they're either existing in sort of a parallel civilization side by side. So, you know, some people would say in the middle of the Earth or in Antarctica or, you know, on the moon, or they're either humans who've broken away or there are other civilizations. You know, it's got, there has to be an explanation. And, you know, we know they're not coming from, you know, from Edwards Air Force Base. They may be coming from Area 51.
Right, but certainly not when you're looking at these ancient stories. And, again, there are some very, very good ones. Absolutely.
Right, so let's jump.
I don't want to. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, there's just a few from the early 20th century that that are off-the-charts phenomenal. I mean, one which I included, which I myself discovered in the Canadian National Archives a number of years ago, what you had are Canadian citizens would write their own UFO reports to the National Research Council of Canada, which used to accept UFO reports for many years. They didn't do anything with them. They put them in a file cabinet and just ran away from them. But I ran across one story from an elderly man writing around 1980 about his experience as a young man in 1936 doing aerial mapping for the Canadian government in northern areas. Now, in 1936, they didn't have satellites, but they had aircraft, and they wanted to get a good topography of the country. So that was part of his job. And he was in an utterly remote area in the Northwestern Territories where he's on the ground, he's looking up at a blue sky and sees this object above him that instantly took off to the horizon, instant acceleration, that's gone in a matter of moments. A very detailed account, and I think this is 1936 in truly the middle of nowhere. And that's somewhat recent, but it's still far enough away that I can't see that as German technology. I can't see that as, that's certainly not Edwards Air Force Base or anything else.
Right.
But it was a very clear event. So there are a number of these that just make you scratch your head and think, who is out there?
Right. Where is this coming from? So let's come back to the 47-48 period. We have the Roswell incident, which I think is pretty famous. Everybody knows a little bit about it. And we have a decision by the U.S. government to not go public, clearly. And this is a major decision. But before we go into the implications of it, let's talk a little bit about why they might want to not go public. So you're making that, you're Harry Truman, you're making the, or a series of, you know, to a certain extent, this goes deeper than the overt political candidates and office holders. You're the chief of staff. What's the argument to not go public?
Yeah, this is something that I have tried to visualize myself many, many times. And I could see Harry Truman, you know, let's say, so his top scientist or his top general says, sir, we have recovered technology. It's not only that there are other craft out there that we can't explain, but we've actually recovered some of their technology, let's say at Roswell, or maybe even a few other events that may have been a crash retrieval. So you've got this incredible, awesome piece of information that you now have to deal with. Is it possible that Harry Truman wanted to tell the world? Is it possible that he had an instinct saying people have a right to know? And I think it's entirely possible. But on the other side of it, you have the situation. 1947, forget UFOs, let's look at atomic technology for a moment. The United States had a monopoly of atomic bombs at that time. The Russians were actively trying to get their own bomb. They had spies within the U.S. scientific community trying to ferret this out. And the United States was certainly not willing to share its atomic secrets with the world. The United Nations, in fact, at that time, wanted the U.S. to make atomic technology under international control. And America's answer was, no, thank you. That's not going to happen. So if you admit that you've recovered technology that's even more advanced than this, the alien technology, that's the quickest way to put yourself in a position where you're not going to be able to share it anymore. The Russians will get it. Everyone will get it. And I think that would have been an unacceptable option at that time, for sure. So the only way to do that right way is to deny everything completely. And I think what Harry Truman had to do, and the people around him had to do, to create a team of individuals, and each one would have a job. And one person's job would be to try to understand the technology and segue it out to private industry to maybe replicate it to whatever extent possible. Another person's job would be to manage the press, manage the media, and to make sure that they were compliant. Another person's job might be to work the academic community and keep them in line. Another person's job might be to find out, is there a way to communicate with these other beings? And on and on and on. And I think that is right. Exactly what happened. That's, I think, how the secret started. It may not be...
One of the things that Joseph Farrell makes clear, and I agree with him on this, is he says, you know, the history of... Of civilizations encountering a civilization which has advanced technology, it's never good for the lesser technological civilization. In other words, you know, when the Indian meet the settlers who have advanced technology to them, you know, they get genocided. So the notion that a group of generals might want to bring our society up to an advanced technological state before letting this information become public, you know, there is an argument to say they had a reason to be concerned.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, putting ourselves into the position of those decision makers.
Right. Whether
they're in there legitimately or not, they have to consider them. I mean, how do you tell the world that there are these others that are here when you yourself don't know what their intentions are? You yourself don't know, are they helpful? Are they hostile? And
right.
If you're not able to control that right away, you've got a situation that's going to spiral only out of your control really quickly.
Right. Well, what happened? Okay, so what happened when the decision was made to not go public? We have all these people starting to branch out into all aspects of life to make sure this phenomena doesn't go public. So what happens next? What evolves from this?
Well, inevitably, it's a difficult topic to contain. And I think what we've seen for the past 70-plus years is this dynamic of those people who feel that they're responsible for national or international security trying to keep this as quiet as possible to disable this topic to the maximum extent possible. But at the same time, they can't do it completely because ordinary people are also encountering this, at least from time to time, and stories do get out. And as the years have gone by, what we've seen is that these stories are becoming more and more prevalent. I mean, there are thousands.
Well, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of them from highly credible people. In other words, this is a...
Exactly.
But this is an enormous phenomena. It's not just a few people. And,
people are not aware of this. I mean, I think a lot of people who just casually follow UFOs are not quite aware of the density of reports that go on every single year, particularly now with websites being able to accept reports. And they're getting thousands in North America alone every year.
Right.
So it's really out there, yeah.
Well, I'll never forget, you know, I was driving across the Dakotas at 3 a.m., I think it was about 2005, and literally, Richard, it was the strangest thing. There were hundreds of huge UFOs just hanging up in the sky. It wasn't just a few, it was hundreds. So, of course, I'm pricing out how much it would cost to build and maintain these things. And I'm looking at them saying, wait a minute, this is over $1 trillion right here. You know, what is going on? So,
probably
so this is
than the B-2 bomber or, you know, any of our advanced fighter jets, right?
Yeah, well, it's like a condo association of UFOs just sort of hanging there. I thought it was like, is this a city? You know, what's going on? And, you know, when it's that front and center, you know, there are just too many people who can't notice it. Because, you know, I don't know how many truckers were driving across the Dakotas that night, but I'm sure there were a lot of them. So they could see it, too.
It's quite possible, you know, in terms of the money on this, I've wondered, and I bet you've wondered about this, for our society right now to build those types of craft. I mean, there are legitimate stories from fighter pilots of encountering objects that are battleship size in the sky and even larger than aircraft carriers. So when we think of the money that it would cost us in our society, it's astronomical. But it may be possible with better technology, with advanced nanotechnology, advanced 3D printing technology, which we're now starting to see possibilities here, that it might be possible to build these craft a lot more cheaply in the future with better science, better technology. And I wonder about this. So it's possible that there may be a civilization that's, for them, it's not as big a deal to build these enormous craft. It may be expensive, but not as much as what we might think.
Well, the way I came to study the UFO phenomena was twofold. One is I kept looking for the enormous amounts of money that was disappearing. And if you add up, you know, if you add up since the 1948 decision, how much money has been disappearing down the black budget? You know, you walk away with a model of literally the developed world is just being harvested for enormous amounts of monies. You know, I estimate since the early 90s, $40 trillion just in North America alone. Enormous amounts of money going down this, you know, this hole. And the question is, where is it going? And finally, you know, I have this other phenomenon where you have trillions of dollars of hardware flying around in advanced technology, and you have a corporate infrastructure which is, in essence, out of control in terms of the national security state. Because what happened in 1948 is, I think, one of the most pivotal things that's happened in the 20th century, and that was a private group of corporations got control of the black technology, and the government lost control. Because it was not the government. To keep this secret, you had to keep it, you know, two steps removed from governmental bureaucrats who were liable under FOIA and other transparency laws and reporting to Congress. You had to move it way black. And so operationally, the corporations get control. Operationally, you're reverse engineering the technology into Silicon Valley, into, you know, the Boston Ring, into all these places. And then suddenly, because they're developing the technology, they in essence control it and even own it. And so if you look at an enormous amount of the equity valuation that's come from advanced technology, a lot of that, you know, if you look at the history of it, should really belong to the American people, to the taxpayer. But it was literally a transfer and a gift. So here we have a whole secret infrastructure of private corporations and investors who control the most advanced technology in the world, and we're depending on them for the evolution of whatever this response is to the phenomena, you know, and it's all happening in secret.
That is so well said. And one of the goals for me in writing this new book of mine, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, is one of them is to understand this phenomenon politically. The whole subject of UFOs, I think, really was in need of a reformulation in a sophisticated way. So, and part of that includes the politics, and part of that includes the money. So it took me a good 10 years solid of trying to work my way through understanding how the true structure of power operates in this world. And I'm still not really at the goal line here, but I think I've come farther than I was a decade ago where, you know, in the old formulation that most of us are raised with, which is the idea of our politics. We vote for our members of Congress, we vote for our president, and if we don't like them, we can throw the phones out and elect new guys. It's almost like the grade school version of politics, and I think many people right. still kind of live with this in our minds. And it took a full decade of myself just working this to try to disabuse myself of that idea and realize this is a secret that's become privatized. So it's not so right. classified as it is proprietary. And trying to understand all of that it was one of the goals that I've had, and it's one of the things I try to incorporate into this new book, which is a somewhat more sophisticated political analysis of the UFO phenomenon and cover-up. And I think what you're talking about here, the missing money, how that fits into the advanced technology, this is one of the key things that researchers need to be focusing on and especially moving forward with this.
It's interesting. Inouye, at one point, I think it was in the 70s, said, or 80s, we now have, I guess it was in response to the Iran-Contra hearing, said we now have, you know, groups with whole private armies and private, you're literally talking about.
Senator Daniel Inouye, yes.
Yeah.
In the 1980s, exactly.
You've moved enough money and enough technology out, so you literally have, you have the financial framework to provide for a separate civilization run by humans with this technology, basically re-engineering the governance on planet Earth in ways that we can hardly understand other than, you know, sort of watching what's going on. And it's very deeply involved with the infrastructure that was developed out of this decision to stay private. And so if you want to understand the economy today, if you want to understand finances today, if you want to understand governance on planet Earth, you have to grapple with the UFO phenomena because it was the development of an infrastructure to respond to that phenomena, which is now basically the most powerful human infrastructure on Earth. Would you say that's fair to say?
Yeah. Yes, I would. I would add one thing as well, which I've been hammering this theme for a number of years now, which is when we talk about the black budget, which, of course, is something that you have written about extensively in your career. I feel that many students of the black budget have not really appreciated the significance of the UFO phenomenon in the creation of the whole black budget structure we have. I'm not saying the UFO subject is the only creator of our black budget world here, but I am suggesting that it was one of the key factors in the beginning. In the 1940s, right. It was necessary, that is, to create an extra constitutional system of funding. You can't let Congress know that you're funding this program because they're both secret. So it was right. necessary from their point of view to create this extra legal system to fund and to do the research and the security on this ultra important program. And as all secret programs, you know, I think it developed its own momentum, its own profit, its own reason to be. And now here we are, an entire human lifetime later, and we're still with this secrecy that's now developed into a secret.
You know, you couldn't, it's very interesting because I really went back and studied. I couldn't believe that this was really happening without, you know, my question is, how could this all be going on in my operation as Assistant Secretary of Housing and me not? No, I have to go back and unpack operationally how it could have been implemented and how that fit with what I experienced. And it took me a couple of years to sort of unpack how literally you could be laundering. You could be using HUD to launder billions of dollars of drug money or other kinds of money or financial fraud, you know, in the system without everybody knowing. You know, how could that operationally happen? And one of the things I discovered, first of all, you absolutely can. And I sort of figured out intuitively how it was probably working. But then I went back to figure out, okay, how did they build the original train tracks? Because you're talking about building out covert cash flow train tracks in 3,100 counties, one county at a time. And what you, and of course, critical to that was the drugs, because after World War II, a decision was made to open the United States up to the drug market. You know, a lot of our leadership had historically watched the drug trade. I mean, it was, you know, the drug trade and the Anglo-American alliance go back centuries. But, you know, sort of what we did to China, or what the Anglos did to China in the 1800s, we did to the United States after World War II. And if you study sort of the train tracks of totalitarianism and how they were built out using the drug business and the war on drugs neighborhood by neighborhood, what you see and hear when you go back and you study sort of the people who are involved in doing it is very fine and good, decent people will say, you know, we had no choice. We had to have a secret source of funding. We had to assert covert control of the economy. We had to do it. We had no choice because we needed the money and we needed it in secret. And that's just, it was the best of two, you know, a series of bad options. And you think, why, you know, why did they have to have this? Why was this a must? Why would, because if you look at the people who were doing it, these were good people. They weren't bad people. And there were lots of them in lots of different walks of life. And so they absolutely believed that they had no choice and that this was the right thing to do. They didn't like it. But, you know, you could never have built those original train tracks in a couple of decades unless you could get thousands and thousands of decent human beings to go along with this. So the question is, why did they think that was okay?
Right. Well, it's really a variation of the kind of Cold War imperative where, you know, in that context, people developing nuclear weapons and thinking, well, this is not a good thing, but we need to defend ourselves. So that, in other words, you could convince someone that it's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it. And so in the context of it, of a non-human presence here, a secret that's even more profound than the Cold War, I could see, and I'm sure you can, that you would be able to convince these individuals that, yes, this is a greater mission here. And,
right.
And the drug money, drug addiction is not a good thing, but yes, we're going to play this game because we need this money. I mean, the drug business is, I don't know how to measure it, but I have to think it's one of the top five industries in the world. Just because it's illegal doesn't mean that no one wants the money. Everyone wants the money. And it's unvouchered funds. What's better than that? Your own slush fund of billions.
Well, in fact, you know, the money is not as, you know, when you get deeply into it, I think the money is not as big as you think, other than once you set up the train tracks, it's, you know, it's non-taxable because you're laundering it. But when you lever it with mortgage fraud and financial fraud, you know, then it becomes very powerful. So it's the financial leverage. And
you showed me this. I learned this from you, actually, in a number of your excellent articles. And all right, it's the narcotics, but that then leveraging into other types of financial fraud, which was a very big
right. Issue. And part of it is, think of this as political control. I can bring drugs into a community and use that community's money to buy them. So I come in, I sell drugs to your children. That gives me a cash flow. I use that cash flow to buy your market share when your market share value has been lowered, you know, by the crime that the drugs bring in. Mm-hmm. So I lower temporarily the cost of the equity I want to buy, and I buy it with your cash flow because think of it as a leverage buyout of a place. And then when I use that cash flow to get control of the markets and the politics in that place, that gives me control of the governmental decisions and budget in that place. Now, all of this depends on the ability to kill with impunity, and that is where the advanced technology comes in. Because, you know, the control of the United States politically is right now driven by two things. One, the ability to create and manage a control file on everybody who's a decision maker. That's number one. But number two is to use covert violence to move out or punish or threaten anybody who doesn't play ball. And for that, you need high technology. And one of the things I discovered litigating with the federal government is the technology that they have to enforce covert violence is far beyond what anybody can dream of. You know, maybe now with the Snowden revelations, they're beginning to dream of it. But, you know, so this combination of advanced, you know, and I always say to people, and this was the great integration for me, you know, soccer moms can't get together and back Tony Soprano out of the neighborhood because Tony Soprano is financing James Bond. You know, so the first thing that happens to them if they start to back Tony Soprano out of the neighborhood is they get black helicopters coming down on their head. And, you know, when you get into these stories, you think, well, why would James Bond, you know, spend all this time and money to stop a bunch of soccer moms? And what you discover is the model is so centralized that they can't afford for one neighborhood to get out. Because if one gets out, then they'll all get out. So they can't afford one to get out. And that's part of the problem with centralization.
A bizarre domino effect, you know, in the U.S. and Southeast Asia. But really, it's the same type of idea. If you let one, if you show one example of people fighting to obtain their freedom, you
win
the whole game.
Well, what I couldn't figure out was, you know, why is so much money spent on the fake story, on the official story, on the official lie? You know, I don't get this because what I discovered in my case, at one point I sat down and estimated that they'd spent $46 million on just the governmental activities and then the surveillance on dealing with me. I thought, well, this doesn't make any sense. Why not just kill me? I mean, this is too expensive. It's not logical. And then what I realized was, no, this whole thing, you know, the black budget depends deeply on financial leverage, and the financial leverage cannot go unless people believe the rule of law is really there. You know, all the financial leverage, both overt and covert, depends on that. So, you know, we need to spend a fortune to build the official lie. And when you dig in, I'm sure this has happened to you, when you dig in and you see the amount of time and money spent on the official lie, it can be very puzzling.
Yeah, I think so. Well, one is that they're awash in money. I mean, beyond the dreams of avarice for most people, I think there's... really? Right? If you actually killed off all of the opponents to the system, I would think that that would start looking a little bit too suspicious. So much better, I think, to marginalize them in one way or another, disable
right.
them, maybe destroy their reputation. If that's all you need to do, maybe sometimes that's better. I do think people,
right.
I mean, they obviously still get killed off in suspicious car accidents, like Michael Hastings, a journalist just not even a year ago, and a number of other people, Philip Marshall, 9/11 researcher, who supposedly did murder-suicide. You know, my feeling is that these are still people who are being murdered to this day.
Right.
But in many cases, I think if, as you say, I think in the interest of those people with power, not necessarily to kill their opponents so much as ruin them.
Make fools out of them. I think, and to me, the most effective tool to protect the UFO phenomena story is disinformation. And a great deal of time and money is spent to marginalize, harm, make people look ridiculous. You know, it's what's called the COINTELPRO. There's a real huge COINTELPRO effort. And a lot of it is not run by the government. It's run on the private side.
Yeah, I think what we see, it's like they're trying to build a consensus reality. Every society has elites that try to create a consensus reality. And in our society, you have the national security crowd. You've got the major media press, NBC and CNN, and then you have the academic pillar as well. And I think there's a lot of interaction there, and all of them are attempting to create a kind of consensus. So in their reality, America is working on behalf of democracy and freedom, and America doesn't like weapons of mass destruction, and America is fighting dictators. I mean, that's the consensus they're trying to create, when the
right.
reality, all you have to do is scratch with your little fingernail, and you see that that's absolutely wrong. But the consensus, the attempt to build that reality, is necessary to keep people in line, to keep people happy, to live with this convenient fiction that, oh yeah, the world has a certain order to it. It's a little messy, but we're doing our best. And they can continue to try to do that. And maybe I don't want to get ahead here, but maybe one of the issues in the next few decades is how well that consensus will continue to do the job.
Well, clearly that consensus is breaking down. And I wanted to bring up one or two. Your book does a great job of sort of summarizing and documenting some of the more famous sighting events. Mm-hmm. But I thought maybe we could bring up one or two just as an example. And one of the ones I wanted to use was the Phoenix Lights, because it was so well documented and seen by so many people. And there's a wonderful documentary you can just watch. You can get it at Netflix or get it, online and watch to give you a sense of how this official reality is breaking down, because I think it does a good job of describing that. So maybe if you could just describe the Phoenix Lights.
I would be happy to. It's maybe the most famous UFO event of the last 20 years, possibly. It's certainly one of them. This is March 1997, March 13th. And, I mean, right, documentaries and entire books have been devoted to it. The Phoenix Lights event was really two specific events, as far as anyone's able to analyze here. You have daytime sightings of a number of individuals from down the state of Arizona, starting in Nevada, I believe, and then going through Arizona south, of individuals reporting lights and sometimes a craft moving down a huge, like, wedge-shaped craft was seen by a lot of witnesses, especially as you get close to Phoenix, passing, in some cases, directly over their head. These reports, many of them went to the National UFO Reporting Center, and they're still online for people to read. One of the witnesses at that time, and it wasn't known for years, was the governor of Arizona himself, Ike Symington, who not only was the governor, a powerful man, but he was a trained pilot and a new aviation, and he was blown away by his own sighting. And again, this wasn't known for 10 years. So that was the first phase of the Phoenix Lights. And then the second phase was in the evening, when everyone, it was nighttime, and everyone sees this enormous and humongous string of lights that meant obvious formation. They didn't really look like flares, at least to many witnesses. It was unclear what this was. The video's out there, and anyone can watch it. An interesting thing about the flares, the lights, is the debate that's taken place about that. And you do have analysts who do believe that these were flares. You have other analysts. One of them is my good friend Jim Delatosa, who's one of the top video UFO analysts in the world. And Jim has a database. He's got thousands of images on his database, which are kind of like fingerprints of light samples. So, like, he's got, flares. He's got airplane pics. He has images of the planet Venus, swamp gas, and flashlights, and whatever. And in his analysis, the Phoenix Lights do not match any of those fingerprints. So he says, I'm not saying it's a spacecraft, but I am saying this is unknown and it's not explained. There was an explanation put out almost immediately that the Maryland Air National Guard had flown their squadron over Phoenix and that they were somehow responsible for the incident. And this is certainly not true. And again, Delatosa knew a lot of the members of some of the members of the Maryland Air National Guard, 104th Fighter Squadron. And two of the people he knew, one was the commanding officer who trained them. And the bottom line is they were not, absolutely not, responsible for these lights. So what you had is a situation that was very much in danger of spiraling out of control, because once it started to become discussed, this could really go places that people in national security would not want. So what do you end up having? You have the city council member of Phoenix, Frances Barwood. She was the only one who questioned the official line, and she was pushed right out of the city council. Her story is fascinating. And then you get the famous press conference that Ike Symington organized right after the Phoenix Lights, in which he brought out this guy in a big alien costume and everyone, ha, 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 big funny joke. But he...
And he later retracted, he later apologized for that.
Yeah. He said we had to do it. And the whole point was public panic was a palpable reality. And was, they were right on the cusp of something that was going to be out of control. So yeah, this is a significant event. And, I think it's too bad that it hadn't happened a few hours earlier in the day when it was daylight and you could really see clearly what this was. But the fact is that, you know, to this day, it's a significant event. Something big happened over.
Well, you know, it's really funny because when I was hot and heavy trying to figure out where the $4 trillion that had gone missing from NASA and DOD and HUD went, and I watched Phoenix Lights, it was sort of a transformative moment for me, and I said, well, wait a minute, I bet you Lockheed Martin would build that for $4 trillion. I said, oh, that's where it went.
Kind of technology. I mean, holy,
right.
There's the money, but then how is this sort of thing even possible? I mean...
Well, here's how it's possible, and I just, this is my prejudice studying, you know, thousands of different things. What I've, if you look at the effort to re-engineer and reverse engineer this technology starting in the late 40s and the amount of money that has gone into that infrastructure to do it, I think the technology that is accessible within that infrastructure is way beyond what anybody can imagine.
Yes, I
told the story recently of on the Solari report of I had a incident where someone just disappeared right almost in front of me, and I couldn't explain it. I called somebody who used to work in the intelligence agencies, and I said, do you guys have invisible man technology? And he said, yes. And now that doesn't make it true, but I had several experiences dealing with surveillance where, you know, the only way I could explain what was happening was with invisible man technology. And,
there's,
you know, the way it happened.
YouTube clip.
Oh, really?
A clip on YouTube that it's quite fascinating. It's gotten a couple of million views at this point, I believe, that is out of Iraq. And it apparently was shot by an Iraqi nationals or insurgent, I guess is what they call them, but of a U.S. military, there's a tank that comes into the image, and you see going from the right to the left of the screen, you can almost not see it, but there's like an invisible figure going across the screen, and then when he gets...
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Tank,
yeah.
You see him a little more clearly. And, yeah, right, so... Is that an example of U.S. military invisibility technology? It's a kind of a camouflage. It's not 100% invisible, but are there ways of bending light around smaller figures? And I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is yes.
So another example I've used in the Solari report was when Gary McKinnon hacked into the DOD servers. You know, he claimed that he had found the equivalent of logbooks for spaceships we have flying around the galaxy. You know, now... And, you know, there are many, many different examples, but whether it's electromagnetic weaponry or invisible man technology or weather warfare, you know, clearly the technology has gone way beyond what I think is understood by the general population. And one of the reasons to bring disclosure to this, you know, for many, many years, I've had a very uncomfortable role in the financial community because everybody says the dollar is going to collapse. And I say, no, it's not. And they say, you know, no, it's going to collapse. I say, no, it's not. And part of it is I'm looking at a technological and military infrastructure to support the dollar that has all this weaponry. But you can't sit down with your basic gold bug and talk about why the dollar is not going to collapse, you know, because they won't look at the UFO phenomena. So, in essence, they can't possibly fathom how the economy really works because they don't understand the, you know, the basic military and intelligence infrastructure behind it.
I'm so glad you mentioned this. You know, years ago, before my own ideas really formulated sufficiently, but when I started into the UFO fields back in the 1990s, My feeling was as follows. I thought, this is a big reality here. This is a very big reality. It must by definition be intersecting with other big realities in our world.
Everything, every reality.
In presidential politics, money. And so, like you, I mean, one of the things I've been trying to understand since then is how does that intersection work? What is the relationship? And yes, clearly, you can't have this one big reality that's totally separate from everything else. That's just not possible.
I don't know if I ever told you this story, Richard, but I was, when I first moved to Tennessee, I moved to Hickory Valley, so I live in a little farming community in Tennessee, and I had a next-door neighbor who had a young daughter who was very bossy. She was about 10 years old, and I was trying to figure out, okay, well, you know, how can I play with her in a way that will be energizing for both of us? And what I realized is I need aerobic exercise, and she likes to boss around humans. So they had a jump king, which is this trampoline with a net around it. So I said, okay, let's have aerobics. I'll say her name was Betsy. We'll have, you know, aerobics with Betsy and the jump king, and you can boss me around for half an hour while I get aerobic exercise. So this was a deeply satisfying experience for both of us. And after one particularly exhausting thing, we are lying in the bottom of the jump king looking up at the skies. It gets dark. And it was that summer when, remember when Mars was going to be as close as, you know, it had been for a long, long time. So I'm sitting there saying, okay, Betsy, now, you know, here's what's really interesting. That is Mars. And you see, it's getting closer and closer to the moon. And here's what's interesting. And I'm explaining the whole phenomena about what's going on with Mars. And she turns to me and she says, that's not Mars. That's a spaceship.
Yeah.
And what I discovered was on the ground in America, there is far more belief in, you know, extraterrestrial civilization or humans, you know, traveling the galaxies. And, you know, there's just far more common thinking about this than anybody. You know, it's, if you go to Washington and D.C., the people who are making money are buying into the official reality because that's what makes the money. But out here in the hustings, and part of it is Hollywood's been, yeah, Hollywood's been busy sort of telling the story for decades now. So, well, let me turn, you've got a chapter in your book on contact and abduction, which for me is, you know, sort of one of the hardest phenomena to grapple with because it's so, you know, there's so many strange stories. And the other thing is, to be blunt, it is very, you know, it is very easy for me if I had to bring any of these stories up to the kind of evidence you could present in court. I've never met an abduction story that couldn't be explained by mind control. So it's a very squiggly area. But maybe if we could just touch on that and say that that is part of this phenomena, and there continues to be regular reports about interaction with intelligent life that's not human.
Yes, I think that that's probably a very good way to characterize it. Abduction, contact of various types that are being alleged, it doesn't meet the kind of level of proof that we want if we're rational thinkers trying to understand this and put together a concrete scenario of the phenomenon. The problem is that these stories are so numerous. I mean, they're shockingly
right.
numerous. I mean, and they just won't go away. So, right, one of the things that we want to remember about this phenomenon is that it affects people at a deeply personal level many, many times. I mean, if nothing else, I think it's important that we remember there are people who are literally are traumatized at times by what they seem to have gone through. Other people who are exhilarated by it. In one way or another, this phenomenon, when it affects us personally, it's a deep, profound, sometimes transformative experience.
Right.
When I see people in the media, like I'm drawing a blank. Neil Dyson, the guy at Harvard, the astronomer at Harvard, Neil. I'm talking about.
I know who you're talking about. I don't remember his surname.
Astronomer. My brain is just But, I mean, I've listened to him actually make fun of people who allegedly have had contact, turning it into a big joke. Neil deGrasse Tyson, that's who it is. And I've heard him do this, and I get so angry when I see major public figures making fun of this phenomenon. It's really, it's a cruel thing to do.
Well, they're paid to do. I mean, basically, that's their job. Their job is to protect the official reality. Yeah, and one of the things I would say is when you see people who have stories, you know, who've experienced this kind of phenomena, you know, the first shocking thing is what happens. Then the second shocking thing is the way society treats them. So they literally have the entire national security state trying to make them out to be a fool and to shun them and ostracize them and separate them from their community, their family, etc.
The thing about mind control, by the way, I think you're right on here. The mind control, you know, there are apparent screen memories that seem to have been put in place to people following their experiences. So, you know, trying to figure out what exactly happened to them is sometimes very difficult.
Right.
One of the stories I did not include in this, I probably should have. I interviewed a man who, he's a truck driver. He's a regular guy, good guy. 30 years ago, had an experience with a number of people. He was fishing at night, and he, to this day, has no memory of the 2 hours of missing time that occurred. He remembered as they got back into the van to go home, he said to his companions, "We are not supposed to talk about this. I am never going to talk about this, and you never talk about this, and if you do, I'll just call you a liar. But we're not supposed to talk about it." So that whatever happened to him, it certainly appears that the agency put this mental command inside.
Right.
Don't talk about it. So there is mind control happening. And the question is, who's doing it? Is it aliens? Is it humans? Is it a bit of both? Certainly in the U.S. national security community, that technology has existed for a long time, to get inside someone's head and to post hypnotic commands and make them know that they are never to think about this, never to talk about it. So there's a lot
of... One of the things that makes it hard to understand this phenomenon is I think it's impossible to understand it or the ability to build an official reality, which is so far from reality, without understanding mind control. And if you've never, you know, researched or understood this topic, it's very, very difficult. And the one book I found that really helped me tremendously was Carla Emery's book, Secret Don't Tell, because it takes it back, you know, centuries. This is mind control is something that's been going on in this planet for centuries. So it's a pretty old technology, and I think it's one that really can help you understand how a lot of this can be going on in the official reality could have gotten so far, you know, away from reality. One of the other things I wanted
to read.
Oh, you haven't read it?
Oh,
no, I haven't. Yeah.
I think I ought to.
And I will also say, I tried to find somebody to talk about mind control for the Saleri Report, and I finally kind of gave up and did a introduction to mind control. I think it was called Mind Control 101, where I kind of tried to give it a brief history and overview of the topic. So that's on the Saleri Report if you can ever find it useful. One of the other stories I wanted to bring up in this topic was I was up in Vancouver with George Norrie, who wrote the introduction to your new book, UFOs in the 21st Century Mind. Yeah, that's an incredible thing. Anyway, so I was up there with George, and he had Whitley Strieber and his wife for half of the program. And Whitley, of course, for those who don't know, was a best-selling author who had an abduction experience and wrote it into a book called Communion, which became a bestseller. And he's a very intelligent guy, and his wife is super intelligent. And she kind of stuck by him and helped him with this. And their story of living through this revelation is very interesting. But anyway, the Coast to Coast audience was listening to his presentation, and a woman got up and asked a very intelligent question. She said, "Are any of the movies about abduction, do they convey what it's like to be with aliens?" And Whitley thought and thought and thought, and he said, "No." And then she said, "Why?" And he said, he thought and thought and thought, and then he said, because there are no words in the English language for me to express to you how weird it feels. And it was at that moment when I said, uh-oh, this may be true. I'm not sure, but this...
He said, that has always stuck with me. Because he said, like, in that situation, when you're face-to-face with them, when you're there, he said, it's as if you feel almost like spiritually naked, that there's no defense, that these, these beings are operating on such a level. It's almost like, you communicating with your dog, and it's that level of power that you would have mentally over the dog, like if the dog is
right.
Cowering or ashamed. That we, you know, Whitley, he said, like, maybe a few people, a small percentage of people might be able to handle a mind-to-mind true connection with these beings, but basically it's going to blow most of us out of the water. We just can't handle anything.
Right. Well, you're describing somebody, you're describing interacting with an electromagnetic field, which is so different than your own, and also advanced in certain talents, that it is...
It's almost like it disrupts us in some way, like we almost can't function.
Right.
In that environment, could be. Yeah.
Well, of course, you know my story where I was offered the opportunity to have lunch with aliens and turned it down.
Yes. And, I think I said to you, I encountered John Peterson less than a year ago. I ran into him in New York City. And I didn't get to talk with him as long as I wanted to. We were both, I don't know, I just did a video shoot and he had to do something. But he was still kind of, making the statement that, oh no, Catherine just didn't really understand what we were talking about and she misinterpreted everything. I've never bought that line. Like, I think you've always been crystal clear about exactly what happened.
Right. Well, it was funny because when,
he said this.
When I was asked, do you want to meet some aliens? I had this image, Richard, of checking out at a grocery store and I'm looking at the National Enquirer and it says, Fitz thinks she's lunching with aliens. And what I thought was, oh, this is how they're finally going to get me.
Right.
So my immediate thought was, this is a way to marginalize me. And in fact, a couple of years later, I was contacted by somebody who'd had a very high level role in covert operations at the CIA. He'd left, but he was probably still doing little things for the agency. And he also tried to persuade me that aliens exist, and that was part of what was driving the need to launder all the money out of HUD and DOD and everything. And sort of my attitude was, oh, right, mommy, the aliens made me do it. Because there's a whole, you get in these situations where, we can kill you, we can destroy you, we can steal all your money, and we're rich, but, it's not really our fault. The aliens made us do it. So,
yeah.
So to me, there's become...
Probably some truth in here. There's, maybe
right.
At that time, you might not have been... down the road far enough, maybe fully to appreciate just exactly what might have been going on there. It's possible.
Right, but here's what I do find, which is you have one group of people who has control of a whole bunch of knowledge and technology that another group do not, and that has become the basis of a cycle of disrespect between the two groups. And the first group is now taking financial advantage of the situation and being, I think, inappropriately ungenerous with the second group. Because that's what happens when power corrupts. So there's a, there's a corruption going on at the same time, which to me is unacceptable.
Yes, absolutely. It's financial and it's technological. Where we have this basically a two-class society. And the one class is a tiny, tiny, tiny group of people, I think, who are in the know. This is why I started talking about a breakaway civilization a few years ago, this idea that, first of all, in the history of human civilization, we've had multiple civilizations at various times, separate, distinct from each other. And what we've seen in the last 500 years is a kind of emerging of the various civilizations into a kind of a global community. But we still have these very distinct groups. I mean, during the Cold War, we had the American and the Russian infrastructures, which were very distinct, scientific infrastructures. So we have this example in our own lifetime. And I just started to think, well, within the black budget world, they have access to basically a limitless supply of money for all intents and purposes. They have access to incredible technology. Some of those technological secrets they can use as money-making opportunities, you know, new technologies to own new opportunities. But maybe some of these technological breakthroughs are simply too good to share with the rest of the world because it would take down the structure. If something that replaces petroleum, something that, you know, is electrogravitics and things like that, that they could never really willingly allow that to seep out, so they continue to develop that on their own. And what happens is that the science jumps so far ahead and becomes classified that those patents, it would literally be illegal for you or me to try to develop those technologies now. Because if you tried to patent it, you'd find out, oh, that's classified. So, so literally.
And we know thousands and thousands of patents have gone into the national security exception and are just languishing there.
Exactly.
You know, if you want to stop an advanced technology, file a patent on it.
A good friend of mine, a colleague, I think you know him. He was at the conference where you and I both attended in Boulder last fall, Thomas Malone, PhD. And he has written extensively about electrogravitics. He's one of the best writers on this topic in the world. Tom also worked for many years at the U.S. Patent Office and has talked very openly about how he saw explicitly how patents dealing with this type of advanced technology becomes immediately classified, and that there are thousands and thousands of such classified patents. So that, you know, we're being blocked from our own future. When you get into that area, you find, oh, yeah, I've got this great idea for a free energy device, and you try to patent it, and you find, boom, oh, that's classified. I can't develop that.
Right. So you no longer, you know, you're stuck in limbo land if you're an inventor.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite chapters in your book is, it's called Weird Science, Propulsion, Energy, Space, Time, and Consciousness. And you lead us through all the different areas of technological development, sort of knowledge development in this area that have been, you know, put behind the secret wall and have really created, if you look at the knowledge that the group who's privy to this has, it is so far from the knowledge that the average person has, that's why I always say we have become as aliens to each other, because we're talking about one group who has a learning speed and metabolism which is so different than the rest of us that, you know, you can understand why they have become a breakaway civilization.
Writing that chapter was my favorite chapter to write, the Weird Science chapter, because what you find, you have a phenomenon. I mean, traditionally when we've looked at this, it didn't seem to make sense to us scientifically for decades and decades. That's one reason I think that a lot of people just have blown it off. It's impossible for a craft to zigzag. It's impossible to have instant acceleration and quiet silently and so forth. And beyond that, some of the other high strangeness associated with UFOs also similarly did not make sense to our conventional understanding of science. And what I try to understand is simply what types of sciences do we now have that actually allow this to make sense? And it turns out we can really understand this a lot better. Whether we're talking about propulsion. So, yes, one of the things I try to understand is how is it possible for something like that to be the case? You know, what is electrogravitics? And it turns out that this is a very sophisticated field of study, and it certainly does make sense. And it seems that these craft are operating very likely on principles of electrogravitics. And And then there's just some even stranger science involved than that when you start looking at the whole UFO phenomenon. Energy.
Right.
How is it, what is there a source of energy that they're using? Obviously not gasoline that they're using from one point to another. So it's obviously something better. Is it?
The financial guys always give me a really hard time about free energy. And, you know, it's all a bunch of bunk and whatever. And I just say, look, you know, there are thousands of UFO sightings and they're not flying around on fossil fuel. Somebody's got it.
Clearly, there's exactly. That's been my logic all this time. But what we find, and again, I was so glad to participate in that conference with you, the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. Because I was.
That was a great conference.
Wonderful. And we both met so many brilliant people from around the world who are indeed working in a very sophisticated way on energy harvesting devices, what we would call free energy. I don't know if all of them are valid or if all of them work, but I'd be shocked if none of them did. So there are a variety of answers out there. And so I think the UFO phenomenon is something of a gateway into that field and showing us that there are other energy paradigms. Clearly that, I mean, even cold fusion, which was laughed at all through the 1990s, oh, that's impossible. Now what we're finding is what? There are, it's not dead, not at all.
Right. There
are people around this world who are actively working and I think they're making breakthroughs. So, and then the science is stranger still than even that. There's space time. You know, when we ask ourselves, is something like interstellar travel possible or not possible? I mean, you get the conventional wisdom saying, oh, that you can't do that. You can't get to hear from there. They're too far away. You hear astronomers saying, you people don't understand how far away they just, how do you And, but what we find is that actually, no, there are sciences that are legitimate. You have scientists like Miguel Alcubierre who mathematically demonstrated how faster than light travel actually is possible. Not technically faster than light, but by like the old Star Trek warp drive idea.
Right.
Is actually a valid idea. It's the idea of bending space and time in such a way that when you're in that space.
You can hyper jump.
Yeah, basically. So you're not moving faster than the speed of light within that environment, but that space time around you is somehow shifted enough that in effect you are going much faster than the speed of light. Now we don't have a source of energy yet officially that we know of that allows us to be able to do that, but maybe some of the breakthrough energy technologies might. And then I try to treat things like dimensions and string theory from perspective. Also because I think this is an interesting of the UFO phenomenon when we talk about either other dimensions of reality and how does that maybe connect itself to the UFO phenomenon. I mean, even time and possibilities of time travel, and I don't know of that, but there are so many interesting cutting-edge scientific discussions on these topics
right.
that if you can't put this off the table. And then finally, I like to discuss entanglement and consciousness in connection with this dark phenomenon, and that's how I end that chapter. The idea of entanglement is one of these things that, again, to our scientific worldview, it doesn't really make sense, but somehow it's true. Einstein famously called entanglement spooky action at a distance. In other words, he says like,
non-local intelligence.
But it's true. So when you take two photons and they're entangled, that is, they vibrate at the exact same frequency and spin and momentum, and then you separate them, even at the distance of a galaxy, they are still connected, and it's a faster-than-light connection. How is it possible? You don't know how it's possible.
I'll never forget, I was, in 1994, I was driving down the George Washington Parkway. I had a big house out in McLean, and I was listening to the Dancing Woolly Masters, and they were describing that experiment that proved, you know, two photons or two atoms can communicate simultaneously at distances further than light and sound, et cetera. And, you know, demonstrating the property of shared intelligence. It's very similar to entanglement. And I had a black Corvette named Fred. I pulled it over the side of the road. It was 11 o'clock at night, and I was walking up and down the parkway screaming, "I knew it! I knew it! I knew it!" And it was kind of, it was...
That you named your Corvette, by the way. I think that's pretty cool.
But it was... I was sure that that phenomenon was true. You know, it's what I call the divine intelligence. And I was sure it was true. And from that moment on, just having that knowledge changed my life. You know, I'd probably still be in Washington or Wall Street making a whole lot of money. But it just changed everything because it said, you know, we don't have to play along with the official reality. There is a way out, you know, because intelligence can work this way. Anyway, it's
I think the science here, it's very complex. It's very hard. It's hard for me to wrap my brain around a lot of this, but I do believe that in trying to understand some of these, what I call weird sciences, I really believe that we would be making progress with understanding the science of behind the UFO phenomenon, because it just seems to me that when we're encountering what we call this UFO phenomenon, we're almost standing at the very edge of what our worldview up till now has been able to handle. And that,
right.
But some of these sciences are, again, they're like doors that open into this, into the future. And I do believe that once we assimilate some of the sciences in our worldview, that understanding the UFO phenomenon would become a little bit easier.
Well, I want to turn to your last chapter, which you call Into the Future, Into Ourselves, and where we talk about sort of integrating all of this into our day-to-day reality and what it means to our culture and life. But as I do, I wanted to talk about one story. Did you ever see the Steven Spielberg series that he did for the Science Channel called Taken?
Yeah, I didn't see every single episode, but I saw probably about half of them. I saw a lot of it, and
the reason I wanted to mention it was, you see the guys working in the black budget side of the military, and whenever they come into contact with this phenomena, they kind of lose their coherence, and they go into a space of just wanting to control, and they will literally, you know, kill humans to protect them. You know, they're saying, "I'm here to protect you," and then they start just killing all the humans they're supposed to be protecting, because they literally, they are so frightened by the fact that they don't have control. So you see these crazy, violent actions. Now, what's interesting is when you watch Spielberg's description of that black budget group, it fits exactly with my experience. That's exactly what they were like. They were, you know, they were paranoid in the extreme about maintaining control in a situation where they couldn't maintain control. You know, they kind of lacked a sense of humor and an ability to deal with uncertainty and stay in a state of coherence. And their reaction was just, "I want more control, more control, more control." And I think if you look at most Americans who are watching this police state rollout, you know, which is saying, "I want more control, more control," you know, digital invasion into your phone, into your house with your smart meter, drones overhead. You know, people looking at it saying, "Are you guys nuts?" And when you go and you watch sort of that early depiction, you see that impulse and how nuts it is, but that's what's happening. Anyway.
A nice kind of visual to introduce at this point. I guess what I would say is, like, looking into our era and now into the future, which is where I try to end this book, we're headed toward a very significant conflict, I think, in the coming decades or two decades, where you've got this control group that has been adamantly intent on controlling this secret and controlling the consensus reality that we're all supposed to share. And at the same time, we as a global civilization are now, we've been developing tools for the last 20 years especially that are enabling us to attack that with with the web, with interconnectivity, with the ability really to have a kind of a global conversation with each other and share information in ways that was not conceivable even two generations ago. So, for example, now we have things like WikiLeaks. We have Edward Snowden releasing all of these NSA documents. And this was not possible even a decade ago because we didn't have the global technological infrastructure to allow it. And now we have that infrastructure. And guess what? We have WikiLeaks. We have Edward Snowden. We have smartphones that enable us to communicate in ways that it's off the charts. And what I ask myself is, where are we going to be in another generation with this technology, and what tools will it enable us that will enable us to fight this system? And there are a number of tools that I believe are just now coming online, and the next generation of those are going to be really significant. One of them, not in terms of ferreting out truth, but in terms of fighting the system, I think is going to be 3D printing. In fact, this was one of the things I talked about when I gave my lecture at our conference in Boulder. It's become clear to me that 3D printing can be an utterly revolutionary development in our world, in the sense of, I mean, right now 3D printers in America are mostly using plastic, extruded plastic. But next generation 3D printers will be doing metal. Some of them already do.
I was just meeting with a group of people who were talking about using it. You know, it can now print metal. So,
yeah.
You know, that's here now, and that's happening.
And they're just going to get better, and they're moving so fast. So at some point, they're going to be doing integrated circuits. At some point, they're going to be doing very sophisticated types of technologies. So just think about it for a moment. Some smart person in some part of the world devises a 3D version of an energy harvesting device, you know, a free energy device. And up till now, ordinary people don't have the option of testing these devices. But, hey, you know what? It's like the world of manufacturing marries the pirate day. And what I think we're going to see is a number of people going to upload their designs, and you and I and other people will be able to download them. The fact is that a lot of those designs may be technically illegal. They may involve classified technology, but that's not going to stop it from happening. I don't think.
Well, but if you look at how 3D printing and other fabrication technologies being rolled out, there is an enormous top-down effort coming from the very top to encourage people to learn about this and use it. So it's clear to me that, you know, coming out of the breakaways, they want to inspire a tremendous you know, sort of reinvigoration of a decentralized manufacturing base. You know, so
is promoting that. Is that?
Well, it's coming very much from the top of the investment. I mean, it's coming way, way from the top. So, and it's being pushed. You know, to me, the maker movement is very much being encouraged from the top. It didn't necessarily start at the top, but it's being encouraged. And same with 3D printing. You know, I've rarely seen anything so promoted in the investment world and made fashionable as the 3D printing stock. So
I'm afraid that at the same time we're seeing legal structures being put into place to manage and control 3D printing. I'm thinking of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, you know, President Obama has been working mostly covertly with a lot of the Pacific nations. And one of the key things that they're talking about is guarding intellectual property rights. And I think that's a part of it is a code for making sure that future 3D printers are not going to be engaging in patent infringement. And that means.
Right. Well, think of it this
way. Doing classified technology.
Think of it this way, because this is much, much bigger a phenomena. If you come to a county in the United States, so there are 3,100 counties, and you look at the economy, what I will tell you is that the total equity valuation, both public and private, from that county is 1% of what it could be. However, to optimize the economic productivity in that place, if you were to allow markets to do that, then the political structure would go out of control. So the question for the leadership is, how do we allow that optimization to occur but still maintain control? And part of it is you need, with digital technology, so smart meters, smartphones, the NSA kind of surveillance technology, which if the NSA loses control, will go to the private guys. If you have enough of that centralized digital control and enough of the legal controls in place, then you can allow that optimization to occur, and in fact incur in a way that you can get the majority of the equity value benefit on your stocks or your private investment pools. Okay.
Okay.
So that's, you know, this is what I was working on in the 90s. I was working on a market solution. Clearly they're working on a controlled solution. But this gets right to the heart of the 3D printing, because what you need to do is you need to build a phenomenal manufacturing base, and you can't do that unless it's distributed and decentralized, both for national security reasons as well as productivity. So, right. So how do they do that?
Yeah, go on.
Go ahead.
Well, I think they're going to do it's going to result in a very messy situation, it seems to me, a good situation, because I think things like 3D printing, and I'm sure there are going to be other examples of other technologies I'm not even thinking about, that potentially are going to result in a mass empowerment of ordinary people that will allow
yes.
them to basically, we might even say, opt out of this infrastructure that we're now part of, this kind of hierarchical financial control system, possibly being replaced by a system that's maybe even more horizontal, one involved in sharing of intellectual property, sharing of information, where I think the 3D printing model might indeed allow for that. 3D printing / Pirate Bay model, you know, where people are just uploading their ideas and sharing it with each other. And if that,
right.
that happens, that I think is going to be a real challenge to the political
right.
financial control system that we have. And where that will end, who knows? That's just one thing that I do speculate about in this book when I talk about our trajectory. And then the other thing relating to the possible end of UFO secrecy, which is kind of an interest of mine, it's been one for a while, how might UFO secrecy end? I think there's a couple of possibilities that are there. I mean, we're dealing with a very strong secrecy culture, obviously. But can it hold forever? And I think the answer is probably no. I don't think it's...
No, it can't.
Whether it's a mass sighting, whether it's a leak that cannot be denied, I think these are absolutely possible. And I think they're more possible now than they've ever been and are going to become more. And then one of my interests, I wish I'd written a little more about this in the book, but I do cover a bit, is the future of artificial intelligence, machine intelligence, which I also think, you know, some people talk about the singularity, that is when machine intelligence equals or surpasses human intelligence, if that is a possibility. I think it is a possibility. As our machines become more independent, it seems to me that that could be a real switch also, and that it may be more and more difficult to contain the secret. So when that secret comes out, that's when the stuff hits the fan. That's when, because how does a president of the United States or any other major leader explain to the world that, yeah, sorry guys, we've been lying to you for 70 plus years now. We did it in your interest though, so don't be mad at us. You know, they're going to want a lot of answers.
It's what the premier or the president of Luxembourg said in another context, but it's the same phenomenon. He says, we know what to do. We just don't know how to get elected after we do it.
Yeah, wow, right. And so there's going to be a major firestorm politically, I think, in the immediate post-disclosure world. Simply people wanting to know, did you really control the media that tightly? Holy smack, you know. Or
what else did you lie to us about?
What else? 9/11, chemtrails, underground bases.
Well, but there's a more frightening thing from the leadership's point of view. As I said before, if you look at the equity wealth coming from all these reverse engineered activities, that should be taxpayers' wealth. Yeah, so how come you got all the wealth? You know, was it really yours to get wealthy on and for us to be poor and targeted with drug operations? You know, there's some real equity questions. And I think if you look at Davos, what's the number one thing they're talking about? and concerned about its inequality. And part of it is if you get disclosure, then those inequality issues get much more troublesome politically.
Yes, I think so. So it's going to be a huge working out the implications of disclosure. I think it's something that will take generations and maybe even a century or more before things start to settle out. I think it's going to be a very, very tumultuous period. I don't think it's always going to be completely fun either, and I don't think anyone's ever going to truly be ready for it. But as I sometimes like to say, no one's ever ready for their first child either. And that's and I think, you know, with something like a post-disclosure world, it's the same thing. It's never going to be ready for it, but it's going to show itself nevertheless, simply because I think we as a civilization are on a certain trajectory. You were talking about building train tracks. We're on a track. And our track is heading us to a destination, and I don't think we're going to be getting off this train. So it's going to
happen. Yeah, to a certain extent, we're looking at a world, we're looking at a phenomena and a development that is essentially out of control. Not that lots of people aren't trying to control it, but it's essentially out of control. One of the things I wanted to bring up, I wanted to come back to the economy again one more time, just because that's my beat. I have really struggled to try and explain what's happening economically to a wide variety of worlds, and I can't do an effective job of it without having them look at the UFO phenomena. But I've always, you know, what I always tell them to do is to get your last book and read the first and last chapter 20 times is actually what I always tell them to do. But one of the reasons I'm so grateful for your, you know, for UFOs of the 21st century mind is it is something that I can give to a busy doctor, a lawyer, an investment advisor, a scientist, an engineer, and say, this is a phenomena which is a piece of what you need to understand if you are going to understand how the economy is being managed and why the economy is being managed and why the reality of the economy is so far different than what you as an extremely intelligent person, you know, who's aware and cares, understands. You know, we all have to understand how it was that we could be this far out of the know. How could this all be going on and we not know? You have to grapple with that. And I think your book does the best job I've seen of introducing a framework for this entire phenomena and explaining how it integrates into the different aspects of our lives. So now I have something I can give to someone, and I'm very, very grateful, Richard. I'm going to be handing this book out, I know, for a couple of years at least.
Thank you so much, Catherine, which is exactly why I wrote this book. I wanted to give my best attempt at summarizing, really reformulating the entire subject, which I've just felt for a long time has needed a kind of a fresh evaluation. I don't really think, actually, that in the history of this, the modern phenomenon, that anyone's really tried to do a complete overview of the topic.
This is the first one I've ever seen.
Yeah. So I wanted to do it, something that includes the history, that includes the politics, that includes the, you know, the deep politics and understanding, and that includes the science and social implications and personal implications and, the philosophy of what even constitutes the UFO today in an age of drones and off-the-shelf technologies. I mean, that's treated in there. So all of the things that I feel are relevant to this topic are things that I tried to include in the book. I wanted it to be a 300-page book. It ended up as 500 pages. But I did want it to be an engaging, fast read, and I'm hoping that readers feel that way.
Well, you accomplished it and more. So, Richard.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Jumping in. Well, is the one thing that I love and that I've noticed has gotten very, like, strong reactions one way or the other is the cover of the book itself, which I am in love with the cover of this book, and many of my readers tell me they love the cover. A few have said, however, oh, no, that's really not a very good cover, Richard. And it's a Monty Python-esque, like a Terry Gilliam type of picture of me with my head sliced open and with a flying saucer, classic flying saucer, beaming a beam of light into my head. And the reason that I love it is that I wanted a book that is fresh. And I think that this is a fresh book. I wanted a cover to reflect this. And I wanted something that was going to, that particularly younger people would look at that and think, oh, that's pretty cool.
That's fun.
It's having fun. It's not making fun. I'm having a little uh-huh. fun with myself, which that's perfectly fine. But, yeah, I wanted it to look fresh. I wanted it to feel fresh. And I feel that cover encapsulates it perfectly. And I feel it's one of the best UFO book covers I've ever seen. And I'm so glad that it's on one of my books.
Well, it works that it's from you because you're the most grounded. I've never met a more grounded historian or researcher than you. You're about as grounded as the human race can get. So you can get away with this. But the thing I love about it, yeah, it's fresh, it's young, it's, you know, it's fun. And that, you know, that's what we've got. I think you can't approach this thing with complete seriousness because there's too much uncertainty. There's too much mystery. So you need a certain joie de vivre to kind of get through it all and integrate it into your life and say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to stay open and learn because we don't know. We don't have the answer. So to me, it's perfect.
Yeah. One of the things I think of this book is that it's a 500-page love letter to the subject of UFOs. I mean, it's basically my attempt to explain to people why this subject has grabbed me for 20 years and not let go, why I believe it is so fascinating, and why it deserves attention from the most brilliant mind, why it's such a transformative subject, such a profound subject, why I think it's so incredible for people to learn about. So I wanted to convey that there's a certain enthusiasm
right.
that I have for this subject. It's a hard subject, and it can get me frustrated, crazy, and get angry over the time, but it's a subject that is absolutely so engaging.
Here's why it's a subject that I think is one we should all embrace. I was watching Robert Dean give a speech online once, and he was talking about why he was for disclosure. And he said, you know, it is the destiny of my children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews to travel the stars.
He did.
And yeah, with one sentence, he just took us out of this terrible little mind we've been put into by the failure to disclose, you know, by the dumbing down process has removed us from a vision of us each having a role in humans, having a destiny, which is one we can all, you know, be proud of and embrace. So I think it's
let's look up. Let's think big.
Yeah.
Let's think big.
It's our destiny. It's the destiny of the young children in my family and in all of our families to travel the stars. So that's the destiny I wish for the human race. Anyway, Richard, thank you so much. Just give us one or two more sentences on how we stay in touch with you and your work.
Yes, absolutely. And I just want to say, Catherine, this has been such a fantastic conversation. I have loved talking with you, and I hope that we get to do this again. I know we will.
Well, I should just say, I won't give it away. We're working on doing something. Keep it on your calendars, an event in June in San Francisco, hopefully, where we can all get together and in fact, continue the conversation.
Yes, absolutely. That's right. My website is richarddolanpress.com. And in fact, it's called that because I publish my books, but also books by other really interesting authors. And I've got a whole a bunch in the queue right now that I'll be publishing in the next few months. So richarddolanpress.com takes you to my site. It basically gives you everything that you need. There's a lot of articles I've written there, and information about my books and research are right there.
Okay, Richard Dolan, have a wonderful day. Good luck with the book. We'll be putting a book review up with this interview. And if there's anything we or the Salieri Report can do to help you get this book out and about, please, you know, you have only to call. God bless.
Thank you so much, Catherine. It was an absolute delight. Loved it. Thank you.